website under Community Events.
This is Kathleen Steele, the covers. My guest is writer Steve McQuitty. We're talking about his new book, Here on the Edge, How a Small Group of World War II Conscientious Objectors Took Art and Peace from the Margins to the Mainstream. The story is centered on a conscientious objector camp on the Oregon coast. Steve McQuitty takes us into the world of Civilian Public Service Camp No. 56 in Waldport, where COs worked at planting trees, crushing rock, and fighting forest fires during the days. At night, they worked on their own time to make art and music. Steve McQuitty, thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thanks for having me here.
How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, about 20 years ago, I was relaxing in the University of Oregon archives, trolling for stories while I was working as a freelance writer, and talking with Keith Richard, who was archivist at the time. And he said, somebody should write about those conscientious objectors. And I said, what conscientious objectors? And he showed me some files and some books. And I picked one up, opened it up, and I saw a photograph. And I saw a picture of a man who had long, tangled hair and a beard that stuck out like an overused whisk broom. And he was looking away from the camera with this distracted stare. He looked like a madman. And I said, I've got to write about this guy. And over the years, I ended up gathering information here and there. And it turns out that he was a member of this camp. And that's what set off a long journey of discovery and fascination.
How did we get what was the organization that oversaw these camps? How did we get the Civilian Public Service Program?
Right. That also is a complex and complicated story, but I can give it to you concisely. It essentially boiled down to this. As World War II was looming, leaders of what were called the three historic peace churches, those are the Friends or Quakers, the Mennonites, and the Brethren, which was an offshoot of the Mennonites. The leaders of the churches actually got together and went and visited President Franklin Roosevelt. And they proposed to him that they would come up with an alternative to military service. And they said, we know the war's coming. And you know that the members of our churches are not going to fight in this war. We never have. As long as our churches have existed, our members don't believe in war. And they said, rather than putting them in prison, which is what happened in World War I and the Civil War, and usually they'd be sent off, packed away somewhere, they said, look, we've got already a ready-made alternative for this, and that was the Civilian Conservation Corps, which were the work camps which were part of Roosevelt's New Deal throughout the 1930s. And as those work camps would be emptied because the young men in the work camps were going to then go into the military, they said, why don't our young men go into these work camps? They want to serve the country. They just cannot fight in wars because it's against our religion. So they created something called civilian public service, and they populated these camps. They did work very similar to the CCC, working in agriculture and forestry and building roads and various other things.
And so the camps were all over the United States?
Yes. There were about 150 camps across the United States. Many of them were on the East Coast. There were a few in California and Washington and Oregon, and eventually there were only three CPS camps in the state of Oregon. And they did the work you might expect, which was planting trees and logged off hillsides and fighting forest fires in the summertime and building roads to make better access into the woods.
And what was it like for someone in 1940 to call himself a pacifist? What was it like for someone to do that at that time?
Well, you're talking about what we often refer to as the good war. And this question has come up a number of times, that how do you object to fighting Hitler and being attacked at Pearl Harbor? And that's a tough question to really answer in a sentence or two. Generally, the pacifists that I found in my research, and I actually spoke with a number of people. Some of these guys are still alive, and we did talk about conscientious objection and pacifism. And generally, the stand was either my religion forbids participation in a war, and that was recognized, or on a political or philosophical level, I cannot in good conscience engage in this war. And in their own way, this was a very courageous stand because this was against an absolutely giant wave of support for the war. And this was a very difficult stand to take. And so as far as what it was like for them at the time, what it was like to be a pacifist after Pearl Harbor, certainly a number of them were not very vocal about it. Many of the camps themselves were in remote rural areas. Now, that wasn't just because they were in a place where it was convenient to do work in the woods or the fields. It was also because the government did not want these people to be circulating with an awful lot of the public at large.
I'm speaking with Steve McQuitty. The title of his new book is Here on the Edge. Let's talk specifically about Camp 56, which you say was a strange brew of tree planting and rock crushing, misery, humor, and imagination. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. I elaborate on 326 pages in the book. Yes, I can give you a little bit. Through a combination of chance or fate or whatever you want to call it, it just so happened that a number of the conscientious objectors at Camp 56, just south of Waldport, happened to be leaning toward creative activity. Some of them were already published writers, artists, musicians, dramatists. It just happened. They were there, and there was a core group. They began to get involved in doing creative work. They spent their time working 6 days a week. They had only Sundays and Christmas Day off. So they worked 55 or so and sometimes more hours per week. They felt that doing this work was simply not enough. And they felt that what they needed to do was to somehow work on coalescing the message of pacifism as an alternative to war and destruction. They felt that through creative work was the best way to do this. And what I found in the research is what's so very interesting about this group. They seemed to be aware, and they even said it outright in some of their writings. They knew that they were not speaking to the current generation. They knew that what they were doing at the time would not be heeded or even sometimes heard. They were speaking to the next generation. Mm. And that's where the art came in. They wrote and printed and published books with very limited resources. They started with a mimeograph machine. They got lucky and found an old letterpress printer at a secondhand shop in Waldport, of all places, hauled it back to the camp, put it together, printed some books. They began to put together plays, and these were really considered, you know, cutting-edge plays at the time. And they did some of these plays. They put together a string quartet of very, very talented musicians who happened to make it to the camp. One member, Adrian Wilson, was an accomplished clarinetist, and he actually played some of the string parts on his woodwind. So they put together this group, and they realized that the work they were doing now might be something that people in the future could hear.
This is Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm speaking with Oregon author Steve McQuitty about his new book, Here at the Edge, How a Small Group of Conscientious Objectors Took Art and Peace from the Margins to the Mainstream. It is a fascinating look at a little-known part of Oregon's history and at pacifism in America and at the cultural movements of the late 40s and 50s. And we have a few copies of this book to offer you if you can call in with a minimum pledge of $60 supporting KABU. We're going to Ani and Jimmy, and we're going to find out more about how you can do that.
Yes, thank you, Kathleen. And this is a beautiful book with a lot of illustrations, pictures, linoleum cuts, wood cuts represented, and it's thorough and in-depth and gives a very good sense of the spirit of the people who were involved in Camp 56 and how they undertook to pass on their message and how it flowed from Camp 56 on the Oregon coast down to San Francisco, the Beat Generation, Kerouac, Ginsberg, the Merry Pranksters, and Kesey, and on into San Francisco's Summer of Love. Quite an interesting book and a beautiful read, and it is available for a $60 minimum pledge. Pick up the phone and call 877-500-5266. We have a handful of these available for you. I think that you will enjoy the read and the positivity that runs through it. This is a group of people who were basically standing up to their government and saying, no, we're not going to participate in warfare. The government said, okay, fine. We have some things for you to do then, which included quarrying rock, smashing big rocks into little rocks, harvesting timber, building their own camp out in the woods, in the mud. And in all of that, through all of that, they came together and decided that what they could pass on to generations to follow would be some of the spirit of their resistance. And that's what we're doing here at KBOO, is passing on the spirit of resistance. And what we need you to do is pass on some of those dollars to us. And the way you can do that is by calling 877-500-5266. Again, for $60 minimum pledge, we have a handful of these books available for you. Come get one while they're hot.
This is your time to dial 877-500-5266. Say yes to the morning radio zine. Say yes to literary arts. I think it's so important that we do highlight authors of both fiction and nonfiction works here on the morning radio zine, especially on the Thursday radio zine, as we look at literary arts and cinematography. We look at film. We look at books. That's what I'm trying to say in a highfalutin way.
Highfalutin.
You know, but that's what we do. We go ahead and bring you those reviews and bring you a bit more cultural analysis and background information than you will get in so many other places. It's well worth your support right now. Do come to the phone with your credit card. Go ahead and charge your membership to KBOO. Put it on your credit card, $60 membership. You can also get a pair of tickets to see KPFA on the air. It's a benefit screening on November 3rd. It's a benefit for KBOO. It's a night celebrating community radio. It's a documentary that tells the story of the beginning of community radio there in Berkeley at KPFA by a man named Lou Hill, who started it all, and how that has changed over the years, and how KBOO, there'll be a panel discussion afterwards that we'll talk about how KBOO is sort of a part of this much broader movement. So please do take this opportunity to join KBOO. Get that pair of tickets to KPFA on the Air, the great documentary that's coming up November 3rd at the Hollywood Theater. And become a member of KBOO all at the same time. Celebrate community radio in three great ways all at once with your call at 877-500-5266.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers. My guest is writer Steve McQuitty. We're talking about his new book, Here on the Edge, How a Small Group of World War II Conscientious Objectors Took Art and Peace from the Margins to the Mainstream. The story is centered on a conscientious objector camp on the Oregon coast. Steve McQuitty takes us into the world of Civilian Public Service Camp No. 56 in Waldport, where COs worked at planting trees, crushing rock, and fighting forest fires during the days. At night, they worked on their own time to make art and music. Steve McQuitty, thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thanks for having me here.
How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, about 20 years ago, I was relaxing in the University of Oregon archives, trolling for stories while I was working as a freelance writer, and talking with Keith Richard, who was archivist at the time. And
this is Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm speaking with Oregon author Steve McQuitty about his new book, Here at the Edge. So the one person that seems to be throughout was William Everson. Tell us a little bit about him.
William Everson was the main figure in the camp. He was an accomplished poet before the war, and he became very well known after the war. Many of his books published by New Directions, which many of your listeners, I think, will recognize as a very prolific publisher of some artists and writers who were originally out of the mainstream, people like Henry Miller, Dylan Thomas, Kenneth Patchen, many, many poets and writers whose original language is not English. Back then, New Directions was pretty new, and Everson got attention, and some of his books were published shortly after the war. In the camp, Everson was the catalyzing agent that brought everything together and made things happen. He was highly respected by members of the camp. His physical presence, he was tall and stooped. They called him Lincoln-esque. He had a way of addressing a concern or a problem or a task, thinking about it carefully and speaking in a way that made sense to a large number of people. So when he became director of what would become the Fine Arts at Waldport, which was an officially recognized group in the camp, what he was trying to do with his idea of art and pacifism was not only recognized and accepted by others, but really shared in a very deep way. And their whole idea was that pacifism should not be propaganda, and that through art, the ideals of pacifism could be communicated. And Everson was really one of the main members of the camp, and I should say not the only by far. There were many, many members who were heavily involved, and this was very much a cooperative effort. But Everson really was the main character, and it had to do with his clear understanding of what he wanted to do with art as a voice or as a channel for the voice of pacifism.
And you mentioned a couple people. One, you mentioned Henry Miller, who Everson was connected to even while he was in the camp, which was interesting.
Right. There's a marvelous anecdote and that I had never heard of in all the years I'd been studying. I found it in the William Everson Letters down at the University of California in Los Angeles Special Collections. And Everson knew Henry Miller before the war through another marvelous person who was Lawrence Clark Powell. And anybody in books would recognize him as a very, very important librarian at UCLA during the 1940s. Powell introduced Everson to Miller. So they were in touch through letters. Henry Miller's living in Big Sur. The Fine Arts becomes an officially recognized group in late 1944. And they decide that they want to make Everson the director. And Everson says, no, I can't do this. I can't lead people. I just want to write my poems and publish books. So he writes to Henry Miller. And he writes a letter to Henry Miller, who's down in Big Sur, and says, Henry, will you come up here and be the head of the Fine Arts? You don't have to do anything. You just have to be the titular head, right? Miller says, well, you know, very politely declined. He said, I can't. I've got too many things going, and I'm no good with groups. I'd be a thorn in everybody's side. But what that invites is just imagine if Henry Miller had come to Waldport, and what if he liked it and stayed, right? So then imagine the 1960s and all those young literary pilgrims streaming out of San Francisco, heading not to Big Sur, but up to Waldport. And the idea is just marvelous.
Right. And there's some interesting other stories related to that in the book that we'll leave that for people who might read the book.
Right. There's a lot more.
I'm speaking with Steve McQuitty. The title of his book is Here on the Edge. You referred to Patchen, and I don't know if you mentioned Rex Roth, but they are in the group of people who became connected to the CO work later. Talk about a little bit about how the conscientious objectors influenced cultural life following this time.
Right, and that's an important connection and a big part of the book, actually. So what was happening in Waldport was there was this gathering of artists and writers and musicians. And I should give a couple of names. These are not household names, but they should be known. There was Adrian Wilson. I mentioned him very briefly earlier. He became a very well-known fine printer in San Francisco. He won a MacArthur Genius Grant in 1983. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called The Design of Books. It's the classic of the field. Another person, Kermit Sheets. Nobody knows about Kermit Sheets. He was a marvelously creative person. He founded the Interplayers in San Francisco after the war, which was one of the earliest cooperative repertory theaters, which ended up highly influencing the drama scene in San Francisco in the 50s. Kemper Nomland was an architect and an artist, and he drew things, and he designed a lot of these books. Now, remember that name, Kemper Nomland. We'll talk about him in just a second. And Clayton James, a renowned sculptor who ended up after the war up in the Puget Sound country with Morris Graves, Mark Toby, Kenneth Callahan, the, quote, Pacific Northwest mystic painters. So all these people were doing these things. After the war, a number of them, Everson, Adrian Wilson, Kermit Sheets, they went down to San Francisco. And Everson knew Rex Roth again through Henry Miller, Lawrence Clark Powell. Rex Roth heard about Everson, and they had met once during the war when Everson was on furlough and went and visited with Rex Roth. Kenneth Rex Roth, just very quickly, was the driving force behind the San Francisco Renaissance. The Beats weren't there yet. Ginsberg and Kerouac weren't in San Francisco. Kenneth Rex Roth had an idea. And he was a poet also published by New Directions and a very, very energetic and tireless promoter of the idea that San Francisco and the West Coast was a place where some really interesting things were happening. And this is in the late 40s. So after the war, these members go down to the San Francisco area. And Everson was one of the main connections. They plugged into what was going on with Rex Roth's ideas, and all these things started coming together. People like Robert Duncan over in Berkeley was doing something. He started connecting with Rex Roth more. Henry Miller was down in Big Sur. People started connecting with him a little bit more. More and more these things were going on. They had poetry readings. The jazz scene was picking up. Into all this walked the East Coast Beats. Mm-hmm. Kerouac, Ginsberg, all those folks, right? There was already a scene in San Francisco, and Ginsberg starts writing Howl, just a couple blocks from the City Lights bookstore, founded by Lawrence Ferlinghetti in 1953, who was plugging into Rex Roth's scene as well. And everything just started coming together. And there's a marvelous quote by William Everson. What he said was that what was happening was that the East Coast Beats were looking for a place where their energy could take hold, and they were looking to find themselves. And he said, when they came into our scene in San Francisco, they found themselves, and their finding is what sparked us. And it was this actual convergence of the two opposites, East and West, coming together that created the San Francisco scene.
I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm speaking with Steve McQuitty about his new book, Here at the Edge. This is really a very interesting and important history presented in a beautiful format. This book can be yours with a pledge of support to KABU. Please call, and let's go to Ani and Jimmy to tell you more about that.
Yeah, yes. Let me do a short reading from Here on the Edge by Steve McQuitty. This is about William Everson. It says, Everson, now working with a real press and an officially recognized group of artists, raised the bar on his own work and the expectations for others. And that's what we are doing here at KBOO. We've been doing it for 45 years. We are raising the bar on our expectations and expectations of others. And my expectation of you, listener, is that you're going to go to the phone and you're going to dial 877-500-5266. This is the place where we're making it happen. We've dug in our heels. We're here for the long haul. We're going strong. And that's because you continue to provide your support. And the way you can do it right now, it's so easy to dip your toe in, making a phone call, 877-500-5266. Pledge your support. Do it now.
This is the best time to do it because we are in the last few days of our membership drive. We are looking to raise $125,000. We can only do it with your help. We have about $280 left in our goal to raise this morning in just this membership break, this moment of opportunity right now. And we do need to hear from you. You can, again, do it on a credit card as a one-time gift. If you'd like to do it at that $60 level or more, you can go ahead and pick up your pair of tickets for to see KPFA on the air. It's November 3rd. And that's at the Hollywood Theater. It's a night celebrating community radio, and it's a night celebrating KABU. You can get a pair of tickets. You can become a member of KABU, and you can do it all for $60 on your credit card at 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
A couple of thank yous. Bonnie in Lake Oswego has renewed her pledge of support for KBOO, and Joanne in Ashland, Oregon is a new member. Thank you both. And we want you to emulate Bonnie and Joanne by going to your phone. 877-500-5266 is the number to call. If you're a little closer than Lake Oswego or Ashland, come on down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. You can see just what we're up to here. You can get behind the mics with us maybe at some point once you go through a little bit of that free training and orientation. Once you've learned some of the ins and outs of radio, we'll put you on the microphone and you can help spread the word about positive resistance to negative forces that are, come on folks, let's face it, they're working against us. We need your help. This is the time to pick up the phone and call 877-500-5266. Let us know you support KBOO and let them know that you support KBOO. It's 877-500-5266.
Another connection that I wanted to ask you about was the connection that relates to community radio, the connection that the CEOs had with Lewis Hill. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it's marvelous. Lou Hill was the founder of KPFA, the very first community-supported radio station in the country, in Berkeley. And in the late 1940s, KPFA began. And Lou Hill was a CO during World War II. And while he wasn't at the Waldport camp and he wasn't specifically engaged in the fine arts, he was published by them in one of their journals. And there are records of correspondence between Lou Hill and some of the members of the fine arts at Waldport, and kicking around some ideas about, well, what can we do after the war? How can we make the time we have spent here count for something rather than just having been set aside during the war and doing some work and then going back? They were always, and this is what is so marvelous about it, the idea that they were looking for a way to reach out to the larger community, which of course is the main idea behind community radio, where we are all involved in this together, right? And everybody is a stakeholder. Everybody is an investor. Everybody is part of it. All our voices together count.
Great. Yeah, thank you for that, Steve. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU Radio and for Between the Covers. I have been speaking with Steve McQuitty about his new book, Here at the Edge, published by OSU Press. The unedited version of this interview will be available on the KABU website. You can just go to kboo.fm and click on Between the Covers under Programs, and you should be able to find it a little later today, because there is a lot more information and a lot more interesting anecdotes from Steve McQuitty. So I definitely recommend that you check that out. Thanks for listening, and please do make your call of support, 877-500-5266. Another connection.
Coming up on Africa Oye, Thursday, October 24th, a KABU Fall Membership Drive special spotlight on the late South African singer Miriam Makeba. During the 1960s, Makeba became the first artist to popularize African music around the world. An outspoken critic of apartheid, Makeba spent 30 years living in exile. I'm Andy Hosh. Join me for this two-hour retrospective on the life and music of Miriam Makeba, Thursday, October 24th, from 2 to 4 p.m., here on KBOO's Africa Oye.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Good morning and welcome to a membership drive special of The Film Show. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm S.W. Conser. Our show this month is the first part of a two-part special that will continue into our next episode. Today, we're bringing you conversations with folks from two of Portland's independent historic theaters about a pressing dilemma that's facing film communities across the country. Go digital or go dark.
The phrase has become a common way to describe a big shift in the film industry, a move by the major film studios to discontinue the release of new movies on 35mm film, instead making them available only as digital prints. Making this change is liable to save the Hollywood studios close to $1 billion per year in production and shipping costs.
But on the other end of those savings lie the theaters, which are faced with footing the bill for tens of thousands of dollars to make costly upgrades to digital projection systems. Otherwise, they risk being left behind with no access to new films, some with potential closure on the horizon. According to one estimate, up to